Nancy from Wednesday Traffic Jam on WMNF. The Dolly Rods bring you high-energy bubblegum punk fun. Known nationally and internationally, this is an excellent opportunity to see what venues around the country have known for years. Pure punk joy at WMNF's Tropical Heatwave May 4th at the Cuban Club. For ticket information, go to tropicalheatwave.org.
Good morning and welcome to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah. I am back in the studio and back in the country after visiting my mother, who is now living in Cairo. Never missing a beat when it comes to politics and things that are going on. Sadly, I left before there is a ceasefire in Gaza and came back, and there is no ceasefire in Gaza. We're going to be talking about a lot of issues today. I'm going to be talking to Professor Zunis. Let me see. Just a second. Yep, we're going to be talking to Professor Stephen Zunis. We've had him before on True Talk. He's a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco in California, but he is now in Sweden. So I hope you will enjoy this conversation. You can always send us email to dj@wmnf.org, dj@wmnf.org, and you can always call 813-239-9663. 813-239-9663. And I think when I was traveling, we did the fun drive. And as always, I should say, True Talk was able to meet the goal. But soon, I think we're going to be fundraising in sometime towards the end of May. And again, it would be great if you can support WMNF and support True Talk. I'm not sure how many of you were listening to the congressional hearings yesterday about Columbia University and about stifling free speech. This is happening in America. And it would be interesting, if you're interested, I would tell you what people outside the U.S., especially, for instance, I spent the last 6 weeks in Cairo. I didn't go anywhere else because, as I told you, I was just visiting my mother. It would be interesting, if you're curious, to know what do people think of our media coverage of Gaza, or if you... what do you think of what people think of the double standard and the hypocrisy when it comes to the Arab world versus Ukraine, for instance? But let's listen to some music until I get this Dr. Stephen Zunis on True Talk. This is WMNF Tampa, and this is music from Africa. Hope you will enjoy it.
And all I love is the new one,
Good morning and welcome back to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah. Good morning, Professor. Are you with me?
I know.
Good to hear your voice, Professor. It's been a while since we had you on True Talk, but I am happy to have you again. Things are happening all over the world and you are always prolific in what you write. Let me just introduce you again to our listeners. Professor Stephen Zunis is professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, California, but I think you are now in Sweden, in Gothenburg, University of Gothenburg. Is that correct, Professor?
Yes, I have a visiting research fellowship here.
Okay, what are you doing? Like what kind of research or classes you're giving? Because I really was talking to our listeners before you joined in that I was spent 6 weeks in Cairo visiting my mother. And I am, if the listeners are curious, I can tell them what people think of what is going on in the U.S. But like what is your research is around in Europe?
Well, I originally got a grant working on the pro-democracy struggles, civil resistance around the world. But thanks to Gaza, I've been doing pretty much full-time work on the ongoing tragedy there. I've been writing papers and giving lectures and been doing quite a bit because obviously there's a lot of interest here in Sweden, as there is all over the world, about what's going on. And it's been very impressive to see in cities throughout Sweden and throughout Europe weekly demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine and absolute horror at the way the United States government has continued to provide unconditional military aid, block the United Nations from imposing a ceasefire, and generally allowing the carnage to continue.
So you are saying that there is more, let's say, activism when it comes to people in the streets in Sweden asking for a ceasefire, more than the U.S.? I know you're not physically here, but you can maybe follow what is going on.
Yeah. I wouldn't say there is much as much activism because Sweden, unlike the United States, is not not directly supporting the onslaught. Sweden, in fact, when they say they support, not only says they support a two-state solution, they actually have full diplomatic relations with the state of Palestine, along with the state of Israel. Unlike the United States, which says it supports a two-state solution, but is doing whatever it can to prevent other countries from recognizing Palestine or the United Nations from recognizing Palestine and generally maintaining the occupation. But I'm speaking mostly just in terms of popular consciousness. I mean, not just my colleagues at the university who tend to be, politically aware people. Waiters who overheard conversations have chimed in about how they are also horrified at the situation, wondering what the hell Biden is doing. I mean, the awareness here is very, very high, and the sympathy for the Palestinian struggle is very strong.
Actually, it is very high here, even in the U.S., Professor, but among younger generation, I'm sure you...
Yes, I actually wrote an article about that a few weeks ago where I looked at that phenomenon. Indeed, in all my year, except perhaps for LGBTQ issues, I don't know of any issue where there's such a discernible difference regarding political opinion and age. Indeed, it's quite remarkable, quite a shift. But I've also been kind of noticing that a lot of kind of the old liberals of my generation, including a few high school friends I know I keep up with on Facebook and that kind of thing, who are maybe just somewhat left of center, but vote Democratic or whatever, but don't but generally avoided talking about Israel Palestine. I've been really surprised at just how many of them are getting involved and are expressing concern, and so though we're seeing it particularly among young activists, I think even older generation people are finally waking up, finally figuring out exactly what's going on.
It's interesting that you mentioned the article that you wrote. I have not read it. I have read your most recent, which is about Iran, that we're going to be talking about it in a while. But I'm curious to know, Professor, especially that you are a professor and you have dealt with young people all your life. What made this difference? Is it really the immediate access to information that they no longer, Generation Z, your students, no longer really have to watch mainstream media to figure out what is going on in the world? Like, why this amazing activism and shift and lack of fear? I think I would say they're not afraid to be labeled this or that, and they're not afraid to be kicked out of school like the students in Columbia and Harvard and elsewhere.
Yeah, it is quite remarkable. I mean, I was arrested multiple times myself when I was a student campaigning against apartheid in South Africa. I grew up in a university town during the Vietnam War and was obviously very aware of the protests, and there were arrests there as well. I mean, this is very much in that tradition. But it is even stronger. I mean, among young people, Biden's policy towards Gaza is more unpopular among young people than Bush in Iraq, Reagan in Central America, or even Nixon in Vietnam. I mean, really, the opposition is widespread. And there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, instead of relying on the filter of mainstream media, people can get their news directly, you know, via TikTok or other social media from Gaza itself. But also, this is a generation, another generation removed from the Holocaust. There's less of the guilt around that, and the fact that so many Jews, young Jews, are in the opposition. People feel safer criticizing Israel when they're doing it side by side with a Jewish student. Also, you know, when I was growing up and in my younger adult years, the big supporters of Israel tended to be the liberal establishment. Now the biggest supporters tend to be right-wing Christian fundamentalists and the Republicans. Also, this generation, you know, my generation, generally saw Zionism, even among those who are willing to criticize certain Israeli policies, as a kind of national liberation movement for historically oppressed people. This generation that's been politicized by Black Lives Matter, and so they've developed an awareness about institutionalized racism and indigenous rights. You know, if you look at Israel-Palestine through that lens, you see Israel, Zionism, not as a national liberation movement, but more of a colonial settler movement. And so I think that there are a whole series of, and these reasons and more, I think you really do see a very different perspective. I mean, another thing I should mention is that, you know, when for people my age, you know, Israel was, under social democratic governments that were, you know, relatively progressive, at least in terms of how they treated their Jewish citizens. They were open to at least some territorial compromise. I mean, obviously, there were contradiction and racism and everything from the get-go, but at least that Israel could portray itself as a more a relatively progressive, democratic country. But now, with the far right, this younger generation have only known Netanyahu, only known the right wing. And so, you know, there's not that kind of a romantic liberal attachment to Israel that you may have seen in earlier generations.
Thank you, Professor. Interesting. I have a question really about the two-state solution. You just mentioned it briefly, but I know that you have written recently about it. You don't think that President Biden is supportive of the two-state solution. Is this correct?
Yeah, well, he says he does. In fact, he repeats that constantly. Just last week, for example, the United States was one of only two countries in the 43-member United Nations Human Rights Council to vote against a resolution calling for a Palestinian state along Israel living peacefully side by side. The U.S. works very hard to get these Arab countries who haven't recognized Israel to recognize Israel unilaterally, instead of waiting for Israel to recognize Palestine, which has been the long-held position of the Arab governments, who've said they're willing to recognize Israel in return for the end of the occupation. But they said they will withdraw U.S. funding from any United Nations entity, including the United Nations itself, if they admitted Palestine as a full member state. And they have similarly, the line has been they'll only accept Palestinian statehood on the terms that accepted by the Israeli government through bilateral negotiations. But the fact is, there have not been any bilateral negotiations since 2015, and the Israeli government has categorically ruled out supporting any kind of Palestinian state. And so to say that you can't have a state until Israel on its own terms agrees to it, we're not going to use military aid or any the threat to suspend military aid or any kind of pressure to get you to change your mind, and we're going to block the United Nations from doing anything. And it means Israel's not going to change its position, and the Palestinians have never had their state. So this two-state solution has just become a line to look like America's being even-handed, when what the policy in effect is doing is perpetuating Israeli effective control over the entire area of historic Palestine.
I'm not sure if you've visited Palestine and Israel, Professor, before that, but like, for instance, when I did, I realized it is undoable. It is unattainable. It is a big lie. There is no way there can be two states. Do you agree with me? Simply because, for instance, let's talk about the area before October 7th. Like, Gaza is disconnected geographically from the West Bank. Israel has claims to Jerusalem. The Palestinians and the Muslims all over the world and Christians have claim to Jerusalem. So how on earth was this lie sold to the world for so many years?
I think maybe back in the 1990s it might have been possible. There's talk of a 40-mile highway connecting Gaza Strip, the West Bank, similar to the highways that connected West Berlin with West Germany. It seemed quite implausible that something like that could have taken place. The PLO, Fatah, Arafat, they all agreed to just this kind of settlement. But the Israelis, said, no, we will continue colonizing the West Bank. We will surround the Arab cities with these Jewish settlements. We will encircle East Jerusalem and bulldoze homes and have Jewish-only roads connecting the settlements. And, I've been talking about two-state solution since I was a university student back in the 1970s. And now, my most recent trips there, and I've been quite a few times. My most recent trips, I agree. It seems really difficult to imagine a way, there could be a viable two-state solution. I think it's important to, both tactically and legally, to distinguish between Israel and the occupied territories, but. I think ultimately we will need to be talking in terms of a binational state that's based on equality for both peoples.
Is it possible from what you have seen and visited? Why not? It's just the only logical, less bloody path to have a democratic state that recognizes you as a citizen, whether you are Jewish or Muslim or Christian or atheist and belong to the land. What's wrong with that?
Yes, that really does seem to be the way to go. That does seem to be the way that most countries have gone in this modern age, that your country is not based on a particular ethnicity or religion, but on citizenship based on the geographic area where you live. And then many people saw, because of historic persecution of Jews, because as minorities, they had been subjected to discrimination and even attempts at extermination over the years, that Israel could be seen as kind of a global affirmative action or whatever, where in this case, let's give Jews their own kind of state. The problem, of course, it was established on somebody else's land where people had been living for centuries. And there are also always contradictions between Zionism and real democracy. But, you know, under more moderate forces, again, they might have been able to, you know, have something that, some kind of system that recognizes unique status as a Jewish state while minimizing discrimination. But at this point, I mean, there's no question that that Zionism now is dominated by people who are quite explicitly racist, you know, who are quite explicitly ethnic and racial chauvinists, and that they have no intention of having anything remotely representing democracy for the Palestinians. And that's why many people who, like myself, who have worked so hard for a two-state solution for so many years, you know, are getting to the point where it seems that may indeed no longer be possible. But I do think that it's important, as long as a two-state solution is the official policy of the United States and that of most of the world's nations, to point out that it is Israel, not the Palestinians, that are failing to make it possible. Because the clearer we make that, the more likely that we will have some kind of peaceful settlement that really does, you know, create a genuine equality for all peoples of the region.
Yeah, I want to remind our listeners that we're listening to Stephen Zunis, professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. But at the time we're speaking now, he is in Sweden doing some research work. And you can Google Professor Stephen online. He's the author of several books, but he writes extensively about so many issues related to the Arab world, Yemen and the Sahara and Western Sahara and other topics, but all related to the Arab world. I want to move to Iran, Professor. Like when I was, as I told you, I was in Egypt when Israel attacked the consular offices in Damascus. And then, of course, when Iran attacked Israel later on. And if you are on Twitter and you're reading the comments by our Congress, some congressmen and women, you'd think that in the morning Iran woke up and said, "Oh, I'm bored. Let me go and bomb Israel."
Yeah.
I mean, do they have nano kind of memory, or do you think stupid or what?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a shadow war, of course, going on for years with Israel assassinating Iranian political and military leaders and nuclear scientists and others, and Iran, you know, supporting groups like Hezbollah, which is engaged in some major confrontation with Israel over the years. But the bombing of the embassy complex in Damascus was a severe provocation. I mean, the leaders of the Al-Quds force, which is the notorious foreign wing of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. These are nasty characters, let's be honest. But they were in diplomatic offices and and embassies, consulates. You know, these are sacrosanct. These are, in effect, the territory of the country they represent. And that's why Americans got so freaked out when the Iranian state-sanctioned Iranian mob seized the U.S. embassy in Tehran. That is essentially U.S. property, and similarly, this is Iranian property. This is part of it. This is Iranian soil, in effect. And so, yeah. So, no question that Israel attacked Iran first. And that needs to be emphasized. Iran felt obligated to respond because Israel has been ratcheting up provocations. They've been bombing Hezbollah targets in Lebanon and Syria, you know, for quite a while to try to stoke a broader war. Hezbollah has responded with a few rockets into northern Israel, haven't done much damage, but they've held back their rather sizable arsenal of missiles. Iran certainly held back. I mean, they have a vast arsenal, some very heavy ballistic missiles that would not have been able to be intercepted if they had done a major launch. But it was sort of what they thought was a somewhat proportional attack, and just to sort of give notice or whatever. And they've said, you know, this is it, we're done. But the
so
Yeah, but the issue is that neither Iran nor Hezbollah or any of them want a broader war,
yeah,
because Israel, being much, much more powerful, would do a lot of damage. And frankly, they are benefiting by just sitting back and watching the Islamic world get more and more angry and more horrified at the carnage Israel is inflicting on the Muslims of the Gaza Strip, with the support of the United States, with the acquiescence of much of the West, and many of the Sunni Arab governments unable to do anything about it. So it is in their benefit simply to not have a confrontation and reap the political benefits by what's already going on.
Driving up to Tampa, Professor, I was listening to NPR News, and during NPR News, I can't believe that they were actually reading this as a news item. And I'm not quoting, but paraphrasing here, that says the White House kind of told Netanyahu, don't do a large-scale attack on Iran. Of course, they forgot the fact that Iran is retaliating, actually, to the attack that was done by Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But don't do a large-scale attack on Iran, and in return, we will allow you to invade Rafah. Now, are these people really sane or insane to be talking about these things, at least publicly on the airwaves, and you have thousands and hundreds of thousands of people's lives that could be destroyed because the White House and Netanyahu decided to play nice to each other? Or it's really mind-boggling.
It really is. I mean, the United States does not want Israel to launch a greater war. If they did, there'd be Americans. Given the United States is the big backer of Israel, the American soldiers and others would be subjected to attacks by Iran and their proxies and supporters throughout the Middle East. Obviously, Biden does not want that. Furthermore, a full-scale war, you know, would almost certainly disrupt shipping in the Persian Gulf, where much of the world's oil supplies comes through, triggering a global recession and all sorts of other problems, you know. So, you know, the Biden administration does not want a major war. But in terms of the lives of tens of thousands of more Palestinian civilians, as we've seen already in the past 6 months, that doesn't bother President Biden particularly. And so there are reports. We don't know for sure. It's not confirmed. But it does. You know, there are reports that Biden has agreed to some kind of quid pro quo where Netanyahu says that he will not go to war against Iran. In return, the United States will effectively give a green light for an assault on Rafah, where we have as many as 2 million people huddled in a tiny enclave there. And of course, as people have been talking about for many weeks, the humanitarian consequences of that are absolutely horrifying.
Can you explain to us, Professor, as a professor of political science and somebody who writes so extensively about the Arab world, invading Rafah will lead to what exactly?
Well, I mean, the thing is that this is where all the refugees and internal displaced people have fled from other parts of the Gaza Strip. And they are crammed into a tiny area. Israel obviously isn't letting them into Israel. Egypt, which has the other border, is not letting them in. And of course, yeah, many Palestinians would be reluctant to do so, given how this might even be Israel's plan to have another Nakba, another kind of ethnic cleansing. But regardless, they are trapped. They are trapped in this tiny area. And there are the remnants of the, and in fact, more than remnants, a fairly sizable contingent of Hamas fighters there as well. And Israel's been, as they're determined to physically annihilate all the Hamas fighters. And it's, you know, hard to imagine them doing so without doing what we've seen elsewhere, only on a more, even more massive scale, basically destroying every building block by block. And again, civilian casualty rates would be absolutely staggering. And that's why so much of the international community has been pleading with Israel not to do it. But in fact, initially Biden was pleading not to do it. But if these reports are correct, he may indeed allow Israel to go through with this.
What are the negative consequences, Professor, let's say, originally from the October war, since that day, since that attack, to the day, and then let's say that there is an invasion of Rafah and more casualties and more things that people can share on social media and see the dead bodies and the cut up into pieces children. I personally, on a very personal level, fear that this might be a fuel to very fringe and extreme people, let's say Muslims all over the world, that they might use as an excuse to do acts of terrorism. Do you have the same fear? Like every day I see these images, I say, okay, for me, I donate, I cry, I do a show, I write, I tweet, but there are people who are on the fringes who will take it differently. That's my personal feeling. What do you think, Professor?
Well, if we look historically at when countries have invaded other nations with vastly superior firepower and killed a lot of civilians in the name of fighting terrorism, it's simply created even worse terrorism. When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979 to fight the terrorist Mujahideen, they ended up creating the Taliban. When Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982 for what they called to fight the destroy the terrorist PLO, a direct consequence of that invasion and occupation was the rise of Hezbollah. And when the United States invaded Iraq in 2003 in the name of the fighting the war on terror, the direct result was the creation and the rise of ISIS. And so if this took the historic pattern, this is exactly what we're going to see. And here's the thing. I mean, putting aside the very obvious legal and moral arguments against the Israeli invasion, strategically, it really doesn't make any sense. I mean, that's not how, there's really no advantage for Israel to do this. I mean, this is about vengeance, nothing more. And so, this is what's gotten a lot of even mainstream strategic analysts and both military people and of academics question what's the logic behind this? That this is really not going to ultimately lead to any real security for the Israelis. And of course, the October 7th tragedy, and it was a horrific terrorist attack, and I condemn it without question, but it was possible only because the Israeli government had 32 brigades outside of Israel in the occupied West Bank supporting far right-wing settlers and enforcing that occupation. They even moved the Gaza Brigade out of the way. If they'd had a secure border, Hamas would not have been able to break through. And so instead of recognizing the security failure, not to mention the fact that they got wind of these plans about a year ago and ignored them, that, if the issue is Israeli security, there's so many things they could do besides slaughter tens of thousands of civilians. I mean, indeed, this is the casualties and the rate of civilian casualties in this war is the highest we have seen in more than 30 years. And that 30 years ago was the Rwandan genocide. Mm-hmm. This is the worst slaughter of civilians since the Rwandan genocide. And the United States is making it possible by providing Israel with these offensive weapons and by blocking the United Nations from imposing a ceasefire. So we are culpable for all this.
I feel that it is like a competition over numbers, how many Palestinians can be killed and how many Israelis can be saved, or like they have this competition over who population number. But I really want you to address the idea of national resistance, because when you occupy people and you put them under siege, you have different sets of laws. If you are a Christian or if you are Jewish, they can bomb your mosques and your churches. You have zero rights. This idea of national resistance, and I'm not talking about necessarily Hamas, for instance. I'm talking about human nature, which is to resist. And that's what the people in Gaza are doing. They, by their survivor, by their mere survivor, they are resisting. What makes these people not understand this? That it's human nature to resist?
Exactly. That when you have, when you're under people under foreign military occupation will resist. And they have done so everywhere. And they have done so for centuries. And in international law, people who are under a foreign belligerent occupation do have the right of armed resistance. They don't have the right to kill civilians. Nobody has the right to kill civilians, the occupier or those under occupation. But they certainly have the right to resist. I mean, I think on a practical level, logistical level, strategic level, I don't think armed struggle is the way to stop the Israeli occupation. Even if it's directed solely at the military, but this idea that there would not be resistance. Because here's the thing: that Biden administration says, you know, that the Palestinians, you know, can't do any kind of armed struggle, whether it be against civilians or military. They can't go to the United Nations. We will not pressure Israel through military suspending military aid or whatever. We're not even going to let you. We're even going to oppose nonviolent resistance, such as using boycotts, divestment, or sanctions. And essentially, the U.S. position is accept your occupation. And indeed, there's any method of the madness of October 7th. It was that Netanyahu was saying we can ignore the Palestinians now. What are they going to do to us? The United States is not going to pressure us to do anything different. They will block the United Nations, international community, from forcing us to do anything different. So we can just ignore them. We'll be fine. And what October 7th said, oh, no, you can't. You can't ignore us anymore. And it is not, obviously it doesn't excuse what happened October 7th. But when you look at it in the fact that they have suffered under occupation and ethnic cleansing and colonization and repression and everything else. No, it's not surprising that people will indeed resist.
Professor, I have very interesting emails coming to the station as we speak. One of them is from David, and he really, I'm going to read all the question that he has. I was wondering if your guest would mind taking on the question of how the approach to all this human suffering would be handled by a Trump administration and the neocons who would then be making foreign policy decisions.
Biden's administration has been horrible, and I've been spending much of the past 6 months criticizing him and pointing out how wrong it is on so many levels. But there's no question a Trump administration wouldn't be any better. In fact, indeed, could be even worse. And that I think those of you who are in swing states like Florida, you know, to say that, oh, I can't vote for Biden because he is a, participating in this genocide. Trump not only would be far, far worse on domestic issues for the United States, but he'd be worse for the Palestinians and other people around the world as well. So I do think as important as it is to be critical of Biden and what he's doing, let's not imagine that a Republican administration would be any better. Indeed, very likely worse.
I don't know if you know, Professor, but so many American Muslims and American Arabs and Americans who are really not part of these two groups are voting non-committed and uncommitted. They actually did in several states. And for me, I am a Palestinian American. How can I give my vote to Biden? I mean, it's...
It's a hard one. I mean, it's a hard one. It's part of the screwed up system we have in the United States, where we do for all intents and purposes, have a two-party system, and where you're essentially forced to choose. I mean, here in Sweden, you have proportional representation, so you can vote for a couple conservative parties, moderate parties, a liberal party, social democratic party, a left party, a green party, you know, and they can, even if your party gets only 5% of the vote, they'll get 5% of the seats in parliament and could have a say in who the prime minister is. And so, people can vote their conscience. In the United States, it's much very hard to do that. And I can certainly see people, in primaries, voting, uncommitted or whatever, to show their protested Biden. I vote in California, where Biden's going to win by millions of votes. So I'll probably vote for Cornel West or whatever. I wouldn't vote for Biden, but if you are in a swing state, it's important to remember that a vote is a chess move. It's not a Valentine's, sometimes you have to make difficult strategic choices.
Okay. I have an email that is thanking me for having this super guest professor. But again, the question is, how could one have peace? And I think maybe, like you said, in one state solution where there is a democracy for everyone. We're running out of time, but in 2 minutes, I know you and I agreed on talking about the congressional hearings. I'm going to play it, actually, this segment after we hang up, because the Zoom is ending in 1 minute. 45 seconds. But yeah. I'm really curious to know your opinion as a professor with these congressmen and women who do not know how to pronounce intifada, or they think so negatively of the.
This is totally misleading. I mean, first of all, intifada is just the Arabic word for shaking out off. The vast majority of the intifadas, including most of the pro-democracy uprisings during the Arab Spring, the Intifada Iskatlal in Lebanon against the Lebanese. Syrian dominance, the uprisings against Sudanese dictators, against the Moroccan occupation of Western Sahara, these are all nonviolent. And the first Palestinian intifada, despite the iconic image of the kids throwing stones, was 90% nonviolent as well. Only a second intifada was really, really violent. The idea of intifada means violence. It's people who clearly do not know the Arabic language. And then this idea of river to the sea, river to the sea. I mean, Hamas appropriated that slogan back, I think, in 2016, 2017, somewhere like that. But it's been around for decades, originally by secular nationalist groups, leftist groups. We talked about a single state with Jews and Christians, Muslims living equally. It's not a call for exterminating Jews. They're just making this up. Now, I avoid using the slogan myself just because, unfortunately, so many Jews have been convinced that's what it means. I don't want to unnecessarily trigger people. But the vast majority of people I know who use that slogan are not talking about killing Jews at all. They're just talking about a single equal state. And people are deliberately misleading.
I want to thank you, Professor Stephen Zunis, for being on True Talk. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to end the conversation so abruptly, but really, thank you so much for being on True Talk. I'm going to take a very short break, listen to this lovely music from Africa. And then when I come back, I'm going to play a segment about the Columbia University hearing that was yesterday at the Congress. And keep sending these interesting emails. This is True Talk on WMNF.org. Enjoy this music, and I'll be back very shortly when the music starts. this beautiful music is from Gigi, from Ethiopia. Gigi, G-I-G-I. In Nurlahu. Oh, God. Okay. She's from Ethiopia, and I think it's a she. Okay, welcome back to True Talk. If you have any more interesting insights into what Dr. Zunis was talking about, and thanks to the people who are thanking me for having him, let me... Stephen Zunis, his name, Z-U-N-E-S. Google him. He has a lot of interesting books and articles. Now we're going to go to the Congress and listen to, I don't know what to call it. And please send me emails, because somebody who went to college, let's say in the Arab world, although I went to the American University in Cairo, the level of freedom we had was unbelievable, but not to the level that you have here in the U.S. as a student or as a teacher. I taught for at least 7 years, and, you know, I am being Arab and Muslim and female and Palestinian, all that in one human being, and be teaching about Islam or world politics or to talk about Palestine. You'd think you have some level of freedom and protection. And then, like when I was going, whether doing my master's here at USF or teaching, there were a lot of demonstrations, I remember, about abortion and about a little bit climate change, but really it was abortion and gun control. And there would be police, and I think sometimes there would be unmarked, maybe FBI agents, I really don't know, but I remember seeing some people with guns, but they were not wearing any like official clothing. And I thought, wow, amazing that we can do these things. Because I remember when I was going to college in Egypt, the only thing that we were able to do was have a box and to give the Mujahideen of Afghanistan. Yep, we used to give money at the American University in Cairo to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, because the U.S. was supporting them. And there would be a box when you enter any of our college. You know, in Egypt, colleges have actually, our college was so unique. It was in the heart of downtown, and there are doors that you enter. So you would find this box, and it says support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And whenever we are going in and out, we put it. It was symbolic, because, you know, what's Egyptian currency at the time wasn't that much. But that's about what we were able to do. And now in the U.S., you cannot demonstrate. Or if you do, they call you anti-Semitic. So let's listen to a little bit of this hearing. If you have any comments, please send them to dj@wmnf.org. And this is True Talk on WMNF.
Thank you. Mr. Kiley, you're recognized for 5 minutes.
President Shabak, earlier today, the question was posed, our chance of from the river to the sea, anti-Semitic. Okay. And
let me start by saying, at least know the name of the lady you are investigating, or you're putting like as if she's on trial. Minouche Shafiq. Minouche Shafiq. How difficult is that?
From the river to the sea, anti-Semitic. And Professor Schweitzer, head of the anti-Semitism task force at Columbia State, I guess you gave a very clear answer. Mm-hmm. Yes. You, on the other hand, hemmed and hawed, and then eventually said, I hear them as such, some people don't. Mm-hmm. What are you talking about there? Who are these people that you're referring to?
Well, I think even surveys by the Anti-Defamation League and others have shown that even that some Jewish people don't hear that as anti-Semitic, whereas I would say the majority do. So it's one of those phrases that is heard differently.
So that's who you're referring to, is Jewish population, some sector of it?
Yes. And I have received letters from our Jewish faculty who say that they also don't think it is anti-Semitic. But I think Congressman, I think you put your finger on a challenging issue. We have sent a message to our community. All of the deans of Columbia University, all 17 of them, for the first time, wrote a letter to the community saying, These words are hurtful and are hurting.
Okay, that's good. And I'm glad that Professor Schweitzer was able to give us a very clear answer, yes, but you weren't able to do so. And I think if I were to go through a number of other racial slurs and ask you if those are offensive, if these are racist, I don't think you'd say, I hear them as such. Some people don't, would you?
I'm happy to give you my personal opinion, but I think the question that you're really asking me is, are they forbidden to be said at Columbia?
Not what I'm asking, actually.
Okay.
Your instinct is that I'm wondering, who are you risking, who are you worried about offending? That's my question.
No. I feel like I'm speaking as president of Columbia, so that's the way in which I'm
answering
these questions.
Okay, let's talk about Columbia. Are there anti-Semitic professors on your faculty?
I certainly hope not, and if I have any evidence that there will be consequences.
You don't think there's evidence of anti-Semitism among professors?
We are running out of time. WMNF Tampa, The Scoop is next.